Podcast.
Listen to The Organist, the culturally omnivorous, intellectually ravenous podcast from the editors of The Believer magazine.
Part of poetry is learning how to speak.
Chilly Billy, Chilly Billy.
I am also a horse.
I really value my life, even though I know it's debatable whether I'm even really alive.
The right reading for this is the one I'm giving you.
Find The Organist on KCRW.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. A classic house gets a hallucinatory treatment.
I'm basing this whole experience off these ayahuasca journeys that I was fortunate enough to be a part of. So you see different patterns, all shape-shifting, and I kind of wanted to recreate that visual onto the Hollyhock House.
Hear from artist Aaron Axelrod coming up. We'll also hear about Frank Lloyd Wright and his frenemy, the architect and kingmaker Philip Johnson. First, though, it's the end of an era for a beloved sports stadium, and you can get a piece of it. The seating and other furnishings of the 57-year-old Los Angeles Memorial Sports Arena in Exposition Park are up for sale. That's because the building is nearing demolition to make room for a 22,000-seat soccer stadium for the newly formed Los Angeles Football Club. We'll hear more about that seating in a moment, but let's talk first about the birth of the arena. In 1959, then-Vice President Richard Nixon dedicated the building. Senator John F. Kennedy of Massachusetts accepted the nomination for president there at the 1960 Democratic National Convention.
I accept it without reservation and with only one obligation. The obligation to devote every effort of my mind and spirit to lead our party back to victory and our nation to greatness.
The arena has also served as home court for the Lakers, the Clippers, the Kings, and other teams. Lots of musicians have performed there. Madonna, Michael Jackson, Bob Dylan, James Brown, U2, Pearl Jam, and most famously, Bruce Springsteen.
Gonna miss this old place. It's been a great place to play rock and roll music. We've had fabulous crowds here every time we've come down here. What can I say? They're not building them like this anymore, so...
Springsteen loved the venue. He famously nicknamed it the Dump That Jumps, and when the sports arena closed to the public in March, he played three nights of shows here with the E Street Band.
Bruce played here over 30 times in his career.
Brian Grant is director of operations for the Sports Arena and Coliseum.
And so often those nights we heard patrons who, despite the fact the building doesn't have functional air conditioning, were just happy to be inside. I saw Bruce here when I was 8. I saw Bruce here when I was 15. My 21st birthday was with Bruce Springsteen concert. We heard that from fans all over the place those three nights. Those sort of things are really cool to be able to hear as we try and pay respect to the building going away.
The firm of architect Welton Beckett designed the sports arena. Welton Beckett was also responsible for the Capitol Records building, the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium, the Cinerama Dome, and many other local landmarks. So why wasn't there an effort to save it? It turns out that when this building was known to be at risk, so too was the Forum in Inglewood. The LA Conservancy says that with limited advocacy resources, they had to choose between two significant modern-era sports venues with tremendous history. Ultimately, they chose to focus on the Forum. One person who admires the building, though, is Brian Grant. He showed us around the arena.
It's very unique in terms of the way that the building sits, even in the walkways and the concourse areas. They're wider than you would have seen in traditional architecture of this time. So having that kind of open style concept inside, being able to see things in this type of uniform bowl structure makes it very unique and very functional for us. You can't help but watch television or movies and you see, okay, we were in Rocky.
Come to the center of the ring for the start of the 15th and final round.
You're going down.
No way.
We were in countless Will Ferrell movies because he was a USC alum, so the building was right next door for him to use as a production house. We were in the latest release of Straight Outta Compton.
Yo, Drake.
What up?
I got something to say.
The Straight Outta Compton production loved the look of the building because it stayed completely unique and stayed completely original.
And all the seating and all the furnishings are from the era. Is that right?
Correct. There hasn't been a change out of the seating and the bowl structure since the building opened. We've done an awful lot of repairs and recoatings, but the seats have been designed to stay original to the appearance and the functionality of the building.
Compare, you make me think of the Roman Colosseum, you know, that's still there 2,000 mm-hmm. years later. And but here 50 years or 60 years old is kind of time to go.
60 years is a pretty good run. In today's market, 30 years is kind of your expected lifespan for a facility. Venue management is an arms race. It's who has the biggest, who has the best, who has the most modern. And that's probably proliferated itself over the last 10 to 15 years. So the development of places like even Staples Center, the renovation of places like the Forum, the soccer stadium brings a tenant. A tenant brings routine. A building needs some of that routine in order to function. We were literally shooting a feature-length film until the last bookable day of the arena. So to say that we booked everything until the very last day speaks to the fact that the building still has some utility. While it's going to be hard to say goodbye, I think it gave us everything it had.
Some of the things visitors see when they enter the sports arena, the dedication plaque to the fallen soldiers of World War II, Korea and Vietnam, the seismic retrofit plaque, the photos of Richard Nixon and JFK, all these objects will eventually be displayed at the Colosseum next door, but some objects can be taken home. While visiting the arena, we met a man named Larry Vanderveen. He'd driven from Alberta, Canada, to pick up his own piece of history.
I'm a huge Los Angeles Kings fan. The Kings played 11 games here in 1967 while the Forum was being built. The Kings went 8-3. They had a really good run here. And it's a piece of history that I wanted in my man cave at home.
And that piece of history is, if you could just tell us what we're looking at?
Yes, so three seats from Section 14. And I managed to buy on eBay a ticket stub from one of those games in 1967 that the Kings played. So I'm actually getting the seat out of the seat ticket stub that I have at home.
Do you like the seats themselves?
I do. In fact, I was saying to one of my colleagues that they're actually vinyl, which is great. It makes cleaning them a little easier. If they were fabric, it'd be a bit of a different story. And they may have been refitted since then, but they haven't. They're original seats. They're in pretty good shape for their age. And given all the events that took place in the building, it's going to be a privilege to have them at home.
And will you charge tickets?
I probably will, especially for my family members who aren't Kings fans.
If you want your own piece of history, an auction of artifacts from the arena ends tomorrow. Everything from turnstiles and concession stands to scoreboards, lockers and break room equipment are up for grabs. See our website for details. You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. After this short break, we'll hear about two towering 20th century architects who competed personally and professionally.
Bring on your wrecking ball. Bring on your wrecking ball. Bring on your wrecking ball. Come on and take your best shot. Let me see what you got. Bring on.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune download podcast to receive a free song of the day. Find today's top tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. If you power lunched in Manhattan in the last 50 years, it's likely you'd have eaten at the Four Seasons. That's the famed restaurant in the Seagram building on Park Avenue between 52nd and 53rd Streets that was designed by Mies van der Rohe. Now the restaurant is ending its long run. It is set to close this weekend. One of the bold-faced names who held court there for decades was the architect Philip Johnson.
He was a man who had a very important dining table at his favorite restaurant, the Four Seasons, which he had designed in the basement of Seagram's.
That's historian Hugh Howard.
It was a place where any architect who was anybody or who wanted to be anybody cherished an invitation And they came and they talked architecture. And having Philip Johnson's stamp of approval on what you were doing was, in the last quarter, say, of the 20th century, absolutely invaluable because he was the maestro that he was.
Philip Johnson is one of the most influential American architects of the past century, in large part due to his power as a kingmaker. And he had a very interesting relationship with another giant, Frank Lloyd Wright. Their philosophies, their tastes and ages could not have been more different. Wright championed nature and organic forms and spoke out against the steel and glass structures of the international style that Johnson championed. But Hugh Howard argues that the two were frenemies, and he's written a lively double biography called Architecture's Odd Couple. I asked him first, why did he pair these two figures?
Between the two of them, they really bookend 20th century American architecture. That is to say, in circa 1900, when Wright was inventing the prairie style, he was the name to be conjured with in American architecture. At the other end of the century, you got Philip Johnson, who, if you turned on the television in, say, the 1990s, you'd probably find him talking to Charlie Rose, or you'd see him on the cover of Time magazine or something like that. He was the chief talking head in American architecture at that point. So it occurred to me that if I could tell the story of these two guys who had a roughly 30-year relationship in the middle of the century, I could tell their story and the story of 20th century American architecture.
Quite ambitious, as indeed those two men were themselves in a number of ways. Let's just point out, though, these guys both lived to very old age, but there was a big age difference between them. So how come their paths overlapped?
Well, they were about 40 years apart in age. Wright was born right after the Civil War, Johnson right after the turn of the 20th century. And their paths crossed largely because of Alfred Barr, the man who founded the Museum of Modern Art in New York, who was a professor at Wellesley when Philip Johnson's older sister graduated. And he and Johnson found themselves having this intimate conversation about architecture, about modern architecture, about which they were both passionate. And Alfred Barr gave Philip Johnson, then a very young man, not even a college graduate at that point, the opportunity to be the director of the first significant architectural show in American museum history at the Museum of Modern Art in 1932.
This show is the result of a trip that Johnson, Alfred Barr, and another modern architecture enthusiast, Henry Russell Hitchcock, took to Europe. There they became enamored with the new, stark, modernist architecture of the Bauhaus school, which they called the international style. Back in New York, Johnson and Hitchcock created what turned out to be a seminal exhibition, introducing Americans to European modernism. But the directors of the museum pressured Johnson to include Frank Lloyd Wright in the show, even though his career was in eclipse.
Which he did. Although when he did so, he didn't really give Wright much prominence. And in fact, he and Barr and the rest were known to refer to Wright as a forerunner, which, needless to say, Wright was not that keen about because he didn't see himself as yesterday. He saw himself as very much the present. He liked to exercise control. I mean, this is a man who 25 years or 30 years after he designs a house for a man named Darwin Martin in Buffalo, New York, when he's taking some of his students to go look at Falling Water, which is under construction, he takes a several hundred mile detour and stops at the Darwin Martin house. The Martins are not at home, but the housekeeper is. And he says, "Let me in." She lets him in, and he rearranges the furniture. He takes paintings off the wall. He finds the Japanese prints that he had chosen. He puts them back on the wall. So this is a man who cherished control and thought he was the only man in the world who could do the right thing by his buildings. So not surprisingly, this would put him at loggerheads with somebody like Johnson, who was looking to interpret Wright's work in the way he chose to interpret it.
And then after this encounter at MoMA and the over the international style exhibition, thus ensues a new path, really, for both of them. Out of that comes two great houses, and they've sort of enabled each other in the production of these houses. Let's start with Wright and Falling Water.
I'm sure many of your listeners know Falling Water. It's in Bear Run, Pennsylvania, not so far from Pittsburgh. It's a house built literally over a waterfall, sort of grounded on one side with these great cantilevered trays that extended to the other side of the stream. Johnson saw that Wright as an answer to the 1930 show at the museum. You know, it was Wright saying, all right, if you want a flat roof, I'll show you how to really build a flat roof. And Johnson, almost like a proud uncle thinking about the house later on, described it as a wonderful answer to the international show.
Because it had some of the features of this modernist style that Wright seemed to have rejected and seemed to set himself in opposition against.
Yes, with, you know, lots of glass. That's another piece of it. You know, in describing Falling Water, I always like to think of it as a dresser, a clothing dresser, with all the drawers open. And some of those drawers are suspended over in a way that only you could do using pre-stressed concrete.
But where it was linked back to Wright's past work was this feeling of it having somehow grown out of the ground it was in, this intense connection to the site.
Well, he liked nothing better, Wright did, than talking about capital and nature and his own conceit of organic architecture, which was about buildings that are environmentally connected to their places. And Falling Water makes the case beautifully.
So Philip Johnson, he starts his architecture education late. He's extremely engaged with architecture, but in no way is he producing a body of work akin to Wright's. But then he goes on to build a house that does put him on the architecture map. Tell us about that.
He decided that he wanted to build himself a country house. He bought himself a very handsome piece of property in New Canaan, Connecticut, a very nice bed town, not so far from New York City. He was doing an exhibition on Mies van der Rohe, who was, in a way that Wright never was Johnson's mentor. He was a man with whom he worked over the years. They partnered in building the Seagram Building in New York.
And he's a hugely important German modernist architect who winds up in the U.S.
Johnson is doing an exhibition on Mies back at MoMA in the late 1940s after World War II. And he goes to Mies' office in Chicago, and there on the desk is a glass house. Now, he had conceived earlier a glass house, but he didn't know how the nuts and bolts of it, literally, could possibly work. How could he build a house with walls entirely of glass? But seeing a model on Mies' desk, it was one of those sort of epiphany moments where he said, yes, it can be done, and I'm going to go home and do it, which is exactly what he did. Now, he didn't copy Mies' house, and he certainly acknowledged Mies' presence, but what he ended up building was a house that was essentially a glass box framed by steel girders and one open room on the inside broken only by a cylinder, not quite in the center, that contained the bathroom and a fireplace. And otherwise, the usable spaces, which included a desk area, included a sleeping area, a kitchen area, a dining area, and a seating area, they were delineated only by pieces of furniture as opposed to partitions in a more traditional house. And of course, being made of glass, it had this relationship with the out-of-doors that essentially no other house before it had. The outside was inside in a very real sense.
So Wright, of course, is kind of, I guess, piqued that this younger guy has somehow gotten a lot of attention for this house he's built. He gets to visit it on several occasions, and he has a number of tart remarks about the house.
He does indeed. At one point, he comes to visit, and Johnson is not there, but his housekeeper is. And Wright walks into the house, and he looks around, pretending to be confused, and he says to the housekeeper, I don't know whether I'm supposed to take my hat off or leave it on. Am I indoors or outdoors?
They were pretty good at slinging the insults. Just remind us of a few of some of their more delicious barbs.
Well, I think my favorite Johnson barb is after he went to see Falling Water for the first time in the 1930s, he was heard to say that all that running water, well, it made me want to pee. Which dismisses a rather wonderful piece of architecture in a very human way, I guess. I think that it was a push-pull relationship. It was complicated indeed.
How in the end do you kind of place these two men?
When I started to work on this book, before we came up with the title Architecture's Odd Couple, the working title was The Master and the Maestro. Because Wright lives in the American imagination in a way that no other architect, even Jefferson, even Richardson, does. in comparison, I think Johnson was this multi-talented, charming, gregarious, engaging, highly intellectual presence who played a really significant role in interesting many Americans in the art of architecture. And it was the art of architecture for him because he was all about art. He was all about design. But I think in the end, if we're doing a kind of all-in-all summing up, I think that as complicated as my feelings are about Johnson, who was a guy who never grew up in some ways, and about Wright, who was in some ways the ultimate narcissist, I think that what they did was they brought our attention in a good way to thinking about buildings.
That was the architecture writer and historian Hugh Howard. His latest book is Architecture's Odd Couple, Frank Lloyd Wright and Philip Johnson. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Philip Johnson's Glasshouse in New Canaan is open to the public through November 1st, and added attractions this summer include an installation in the lake there by Yayoi Kusama. Meanwhile, back in LA, a Frank Lloyd Wright house has been getting the artistic treatment. A young artist named Aaron Axelrod has been given free rein to put his mark on the Hollyhock House and the Barnsdall Art Park that it sits in.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty crazy that the city is giving me access to take over the entire campus. I kind of wanted to douse it with paint, but they didn't let me. So I had to think of another way to make some art onto that property without touching it in any way.
So he's covered the house in swirling video installations made possible by projection mapping. That is the process of using software to map a non-flat surface and project videos on it that match the object's contours.
When I first saw that piece of architecture, there's so many blank walls and angular surfaces. It was just the perfect place to projection map. There aren't that many windows. Everything is very squared and rectangular and very geometric, and it lends itself very well to projection mapping because each side is technically its own screen.
He's also created massive neon-lit sculptures and a painting made of Swarovski crystals. Swarovski is a show sponsor. If Frank Lloyd Wright drew inspiration for his house from a flower, the hollyhock, the artist Aaron Axelrod drew inspiration for his art installation from a very different plant, as he told DNA producer Avishai Artsy.
I'm basing this whole experience off these ayahuasca journeys that I was fortunate enough to be a part of.
And ayahuasca is a drug that's often used in sort of South American, like, shamanic rituals, and often involves vomiting at the end.
I wouldn't actually call it a drug, though.
It's a plant.
It's a plant. I mean, I guess a lot of drugs come from plants, but it's while you're on doing this thing, you see all these weird colors that you've never even knew existed. You see geometric shapes, you see different patterns, all shape-shifting, and I kind of wanted to recreate that visual onto the Hollyhock House just because it was the absolute most amazing, beautiful experience that I've ever witnessed, hands down. And so if I could kind of get people to enjoy that as well without having to drink that nasty stuff, I mean, I think it would be really great.
Aaron Axelrod's career survey, Dark Matter, will be staged at Barnsdall Art Park this Saturday and Sunday. It kicks off with a fundraiser Friday night for Barnsdall Art Park Foundation. You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Food trucks in Los Angeles are constantly outpacing each other with design and cuisine. But who can top fresh pasta brought to you by an actual Italian prince? Emanuele Filiberto di Savoia is grandson of the last king of Italy, which is now a republic, and he likes to have fun with his royal heritage. Di Savoia was in exile until 2002 when he returned to Italy and came first place in their version of Dancing with the Stars. His latest project, cooked up with LA chef Mirko Paderno, is a food truck. It features the title Prince of Venice in a logo incorporating the family crest over an image of the city of Venice, Italy. It pumps out Italian opera, and unlike most other food trucks, it does not have the narrow window that you peek up through to place your orders. Rather, the whole front of the truck is a large glass window.
I wanted to create the first in Los Angeles fresh handmade pasta truck. So I began designing this truck, which is quite a new way of looking at trucks, with a big window shield like you see in modern kitchens today, where it's important, I think, to see people cook. What do they cook? And then I put this pasta machine in it, where quite easily, with eggs, flour, and water, you do all kind of different pastas. What I want to do is the best of Italy meets the best of America. All the products that I can buy here, organic, let's say, from tomatoes to basil to eggs, eggplant, for example, here, I buy it from little farms outside Los Angeles. And truffles, flour, olive oil, I import it from Italy.
All the branding around this truck is around your family's title.
Yes, no, in Italy, well, now there's the Republic since 1946, but I like playing on this thing. And, you know, I think royalties, and it's something that interests people. And, you know, if you have it, why not use it?
But you yourself are not based in L.A. You're based in Monte Carlo. So why L.A.?
Because L.A. is an incredible town. First of all, I love L.A. And L.A. is the mecca of food trucks.
You are Italian. You know as well as anybody that the Italians have, not only is there a great sense of history and culture around food, but also around the eating of food. And the eating of food is usually done sitting at a table. Have your Italian friends and family been in shock that you've decided to bring Italian food to a food truck where people come and stand and eat it out of their hands?
I love this way of eating. I think today we are in a world where everything goes very fast, and people don't have time to eat in a restaurant, and most of it to spend as much as they spend. So I think it's a new way of seeing food and of eating. For this, I'm more American than Italian.
Have you planned out your route that you're going to take in LA yet?
I think we'll be a lot in next to the big offices, next to perhaps museums. I also want at night to find two or three, let's say, or one or two parking lots where I can do, not a restaurant, but I have some big tables. Everyone can come, eat. They can bring, as is private, their own bottle of wine, and they can have great pasta. So it's also a new way of looking at a dinner-wise, or something convivial, something nice. I think something young also.
The long tables, that's an interesting idea. That would advance the concept, as it were. So could you imagine bringing a food truck to Italy?
I don't know if I could imagine bringing a food truck in Italy, because Italians still don't have the idea of the food truck. And you know, like, for example, Starbucks never worked in Italy because coffee is really Italian. I think the kind of pasta I make is the kind of pasta Italian wants to eat at home, done by the wife, the mother, or the grandmother. So the big chance you have here in Los Angeles is that you can eat like eating at home, but with my food truck.
Prince of Venice took to the roads yesterday. You can follow it online. I'm Frances Anderton, and that's it for today's show. Avishai Artsy is DNA's producer. JC Swatek mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman and Stephanie Case. Thank you very much for listening. Stay tuned for The World, coming up next.